Welcome to the DigiDay podcast. I'm Brian Morrissey. I am very excited for this week's guest because it was a long time in the making. I have been bugging The Athletic to come on this podcast for well over a year, and it is finally happening. I sat down with Adam Hansman, who is a co-founder of The Athletic, to discuss how he and fellow co-founder Alex Mather came up with the then heretical notion that people would pay for high-quality sports coverage while they were working at a tracking app, Strava. Those of you who are into cycling know Strava very well. But Adam and I got into the details of The Athletic's bet on subscriptions, whether the math will work as it looks to pass 1 million subscribers, and what the doubters get wrong about The Athletic's model. By the way, on that subject, remember to subscribe to DigiDay Plus, our own membership program that gives you unlimited access to DigiDay content, exclusive research, and members-only content. If you use podcast at checkout, you'll get 20% off. Now, here's my conversation with Adam. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Brian.
Give me the origin story. I'm a happy customer. I've mentioned The Athletic a few times on this podcast, but talk to you and Alex, co-founder, were at Strava, a subscription-based business. So explain what you guys saw was going on that made you think that there is an opening here in media for a subscription service.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a couple of things. First of all, as fans, we were both living in San Francisco at Strava at the time, you know, sort of frustrated being those expat fans at the level of quality that we saw was deteriorating, and just the amount of quality and the amount of coverage that was there for the teams that we cared about. I'm from Cincinnati originally. Alex, as you know, is from Philadelphia. So we both grew up reading newspapers, and to see, you know, the multi-decade decline of newspapers due to a lot of factors was sort of aggregating as consumers of media, as sports fans fundamentally. And so that was kind of the sort of the inception moment in terms of this is just like personally sort of a point of frustration. And then, you know, thinking
This was during like what, like 2015? Because I mean, you launched.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
So we started
having conversations in 2015, kind of late in the year. And, you know, basically, you know, Strava is a subscription business as well. So we learned a lot from Strava in terms of the mechanics of the model and thinking about, you know, customer acquisition, thinking about the funnel and thinking about the metrics that matter the most. But Strava is not a media company fundamentally.
Right.
And so this was...
Is that an advantage or disadvantage?
I think it was both. Sort of having a fresh perspective on media, having a somewhat of a fan perspective, though not like the like sort of the user generated content angle that that tends to lend to, but I think fresh set of eyes on media was helpful. I think we've also sort of become aware of our sort of blind spots in terms of, you know, editorial infrastructure and having great editors and, you know, knowing how to handle sensitive situation around reporting of a story. And so we've really tried to hire well there from kind of the chief content officer that we, you know, pulled from Sports Illustrated on down to just, you know, managing editors and staff editors and making sure we catch, you know, factual inaccuracies before they go out or even just, you know, the basic typo.
Mm-hmm. So when you started presenting this model, let's say to VCs or to anyone sort of maybe in the industry or adjacent to the industry, what was some of the pushback you got, or was there none?
Yeah, I think investors were hopeful, but I think they were skeptical. And I think there's still some skepticism about our model, but we've, you know, largely gone out now. And
but what was the skepticism you heard sort of?
People won't pay. Won't pay for media, for content. This was still early days in terms of kind of Netflix's ascendance and, you know, Spotify, some of these other subscription services. Obviously not in journalism and media, but, you know, still fairly early days for those services and businesses in 2016. So this was just a new, you know, the general comment was, if you build a subscription model in media, that's great. And sort of all the aspects of a subscription business in terms of direct revenue, recurring revenue, sort of that the D2C sort of framework gets investors very excited. It's just sort of how do you get there, right? What's the question, so.
Right. But what made you think that you can do it with like high quality journalism? Because I mean, it's different when you're building a piece of software. Just the mechanics are completely different in these kinds of businesses.
Right.
That's why I'm interested in you not being in media, because I think some people in media wouldn't have done it, particularly then.
Well, we had to learn. I think, you know, we were not able to raise a lot of sort of outside capital late 2015, early 2016. And so our sort of methodology was really, let's go into one market. Let's see what happens. Try out a bunch of things, make mistakes.
That was Chicago?
That was Chicago. So okay. Chicago was our first market. We launched actually with a couple of folks from, they were at the ESPN Chicago local site, which is, you know, ESPN sort of gotten away from that.
Right.
And, you know, hired a team of folks covering Cubs, Bears, Bulls, Blackhawks, White Sox, and just went out and wanted to see what would happen. Had a good staff of, you know, sort of reputable folks that had been credentialed by the teams. And so, you know, sort of had that, you know, that baseline. But really that first year, which was slow, I think we ended the year right around 4,000 subscribers versus the, you know, over 600 we talk about now. So it was slow, but we learned a lot in terms of what is it that fans are willing to pay for. That was really that first year, was just putting a lot of stories and formats out sort of into the wild and sort of very meticulously tracking mm-hmm. what was working and what wasn't.
So it started with a local focus, but now there's much more national coverage.
Yeah, I would say it's both. You know, we originally, our blinder, like Alex and I, thinking about the vision was really market by market, and it was a very local focus, because that was the frustration we were feeling just as fans. It was less about, like, can I get the headlines and sort of the breaking news. It was more about just my teams, right? But, you know, sort of as time went by, I think the talent, you know, the sort of top shelf, you know, news breaking talent, and just like the best sort of some of the best talent from places like ESPN or Fox Sports or SI, when, you know, the sort of ill-fated pivot to video began to be a thing, and in sort of early 2017 allowed us to kind of opportunistically go beyond local. And so we've done that, but I would say we're still committed to local. It's, you know,
is that the main driver for subscribers? I know I'm sort of an expat fan too of right. Philadelphia teams, so you know, that's definitely the draw for me. The national stuff is good to have.
I think it is. That's the hook. I mean, we obsess over our engagement metrics and making sure that you, as, you know, an Eagles fan, is opening the app every day and getting something high quality. Because, you know, let's face it, there's a lot of content out there. Many sports fans are content to just scroll through their Twitter feeds to kind of get the news of the day. And so I think local is that, that's sort of the LTV of the model, is really like keeping you sort of staying in your rotation every morning to find out what's going on with, say, Philadelphia sports.
Right. So let's talk about the numbers. Are we ready for the numbers?
Let's do it.
Okay. Because we're going through this period where there's a lot of consolidation going on in media right now, and people are trading like funny money. It's like, you know, oh, it's a $300 million all stock deal and sure. stuff like this. It's like, is it really $300 million? Hard to say.
Right.
But a lot of these companies that were ad supported, the numbers ultimately didn't really work great. So you guys are also on the venture capital train.
Sure.
You're what, up to 90 million?
That's right.
90 million.
Yeah.
Okay. Not making money yet, obviously, otherwise you wouldn't be taking venture capital.
Yeah, we're not profitable yet, but I think, you know, the way, a couple of just thoughts there. I mean, we're obsessed with profitability long term, obviously getting to a level of subscribers and revenue that, you know, ultimately will support and sustain the work that we do.
So what are those levels? Because you're at 600,000, more than 600,000?
We've crossed 600K in August. Not sure how often we'll sort of put new numbers out there, but
what better time than now?
Yeah, exactly. Over 600,000. maybe that's news. But what we've talked about is, you know, getting to 1 million subscribers would make us, you know, the fourth largest subscription publisher, as far as we know, in the world. You're talking about companies like the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, Financial Times, and a couple of others. But but being in that sort of rarefied air, you know, I think we would feel, you know, at that point, just incredibly secure in the foundation that we've built. You know, we see 90% engagement, you know, weekly during busy sports time. We're seeing over 80% of our subscribers renew every year. And so getting over, you know, that level, you know, we feel very, very good about, you know, the model's permanence and our permanence and sort of platform to go beyond and keep growing. And, you know, long-term, I think valuation questions in the short-term aside, you know, we believe there's a $1 billion company to build here, which might sound crazy. But, you know, look at the New York Times with their, you know, 4 million digital subscribers. You know, they're a $1 billion publicly traded company. I don't know if an IPO is in our future. But
their revenue per user is far higher than your revenue per user.
It is.
Which is the lever that needs to go up?
Yeah, I think it's less about price. As I've even talked about with, I think, one of the reporters on your staff recently was, you know, we believe sports is a mainstream category. We think it's accessible. We want to be accessible to as many fans as we can. And, I think there are 50 million sports fans kind of in the U.S. at least. So being sort of accessible at a, price point for as many of those people as we can is really the goal.
So you need a lot more people. I mean, like you mentioned, the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal charges a lot of money,
and and the Times does
or something.
Exactly. So all those names that I said it. I think probably the TAM is somewhat smaller. Now, will we ever get
explain TAM?
TAM, yeah, dropping jargon on you here. TAM is total addressable market. So basically, the number of people, consumers, businesses, advertisers that are sort of in your universe in terms of the product that you're putting out there. And so for us, at least, globally, that's just sports fans. And, the segment of sports fans we're targeting are people that really care, that know the difference between, just a headline about a story, who won the game, and sort of the true insight about the teams that you really care about.
So in that way, it seems like your addressable market would be bigger than the New York Times' addressable market, right?
And that's what we believe too. And
because
that's
why Netflix, the New York Times, I think, has an issue, and that's why they're doing a lot of stuff with cooking and stuff like this. And that the addressable market is just not as big. They have to go global to get the kind of, they're not going to get to Netflix type numbers.
Yeah, I think their CEO talked about 10 million subscribers as sort of their goal over the next five or so years.
Can you beat them to it? I'm trying to go.
Yeah, exactly. no, I think we have incredible respect and admiration for what the Times has done. I mean that seriously. And, I think we're doing different things. We're targeting sort of different, I think, readers, but at the same time, a lot of similarities in model. A lot to learn from them. And, they were sort of first in terms of really recognizing the need to monetized digitally and not just sort of ride off of, print circulation revenues.
Right. I know you're going to say you just focus on the day-to-day of the company, but I'm going to ask you anyway, because you had a tweet recently sort of pushing back on critics of the model.
Sure.
Because it does have critics out there that the numbers ultimately won't work.
Right.
And I think it was something along, you tweeted something, and when we do get to 10 million, then they'll say, something else. You're not solving the world's problems.
That's probably true. I honestly, I don't mind the criticism. I see it as motivational. I don't know whether or not we'll ever get to 10 million subs. I believe there's a massive opportunity in sports. But, as far as criticism of us goes, I think a lot of it is, it's not so much criticism, it's more just skepticism.
Yeah.
We really are a new, sort of a one-of-a-kind, business that Alex and I have started. And, sort of going against every instinct that sort of the industry has had over.
What do you think people misunderstand about the model from the outside?
Yeah, I think part of it is, there's a sort of wave of hires and announcements with us. We hire a bunch of folks, behaving sort of fairly aggressively in terms of constructing the staff and launching new markets, going into the UK, launching podcasts, all these things. And then, sort of the idea of like, hey, we'll find out in a year or 2 years whether or not this works, quote unquote, versus the way we actually manage the business. Every single day, I'm spending hours and hours of my time personally, still to this day, like looking at the trends in terms of which stories are bringing subscribers in, like how are the metrics? And so it's less of a binary thing. And I don't think people quite grasp that, which is like, we kind of control our destiny every morning when we put out sort of the new slate of content, the 150 to 200 stories that we publish every day. Is like, we can see the impact of those stories, and we're sort of constantly talk to anyone on our staff. They can constantly see, if a story drove X amount of interest versus Y, and like sort of the ongoing self-optimization that we're able to do is like allows us to really feel like we're in control, as opposed to just, let's just hire people and see what happens kind of thing.
I wonder, you don't have the media company experience, but like whether it's more similar to a DTC company than it is to a media company from the inside. Obviously the journalism is the same, but the rhythms could be completely different.
I think it feels like a media company when you're inside of it. Not that I would know, but just like if you talk to the staff, this is, they're in stadiums, they're at practice facilities, just like they would have been in an old job. And we've changed a lot of things for these folks in terms of how, productivity expectations versus, being somewhere where you're expected to write 2 to 3 times per day. Mm-hmm. We really dial that down and tell people to just focus on quality. We give our staff, and I think this makes us unique, we give our staff access to basically all of the data.
So what is that data that they get? They have a dashboard that
exactly
that shows them what's resonating with subscribers, what's drawing in new subscribers?
It's both of those things. And so it's not clicks the way you would sort of traditionally think about it if you're, you know, using Chartbeat or something like that, but it's really understanding if a specific piece of content, if a story led someone to literally pay for the subscription sort of via that, you know, paywall in that article, or even just amongst our current subscribers, which is the more important part, is just keeping subscribers happy and engaged, is, what percentage of our Eagles followers read the, you know, the Sheil Kapadia story from
99.9%.
Probably. but I'll give you another example on that front. You know, I think in terms of the kind of the day-to-day experience, we recently put out a story you might have read. Bo Wolf is our other Eagles reporter you might read. He wrote a story. Basically, he had interviewed the backup quarterback, Josh McCown, and more or less a transcript story, but it was, you know, asking Josh if he could recall all 37 touchdown passes. Who were the receivers for those passes over the span of, you know, his like 18-year career or whatever.
Very
it was.
Clever. Very clever.
Clever angle, right? And the anecdotes that he got back were quite good. And so this story sort of picked up and, you know, drove a lot of interest, certainly among existing subscribers. But it actually, like, and you talked to Bo, he could see this in his numbers, was the story drove close to 300 subscribers. And, like, what does that mean? Feels like a lot, right? But 300 subscribers, if we're able to keep 100% of those people, which, you know, who knows, but, you know, that's approximately 20,000 of sort of recurring revenue from, like, one story, right? Versus, like, if that were a free story available to the public, you know, you would probably need the entire city of Philadelphia to click on that article in order to, like, sort of make up the... And so, focusing and optimizing for different things, I think, is a big difference. But we're just focused on quality. I don't think the editorial staff would feel like they're in some kind of, you know, tech startup environment. Mm-hmm. Really doing the same job, just focusing on different things.
Okay, so they don't have, like, monthly OKR meetings or anything?
We do those at HQ, but, no, the writers do not have OKRs.
Okay, good. But are they incentivized? How are they incentivized to drive subscribers?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the beauty is we see when Bo puts out a really creative story, just to use him as an example for a second, like, that's a good story sort of objectively. And so, you know, obviously we can see that when, like, someone puts out quality work, it leads to things that we care about sort of from a commercial standpoint. Mm-hmm. But, you know, really the way we incentivize folks is we pay them well. We give every sort of full-time employee stock options, equity in the company. You know, obviously we're very focused on metrics, but we try not to let that sort of bleed into, you know, if someone's doing great work on a beat for a team that's terrible, like, we're not penalizing people for that. There's not, like, punitive measures. It's, you know, we also used to get a little bit clever in terms of subscriber bonuses based on market level metrics or individual metrics. And we've sort of moved away from that. It didn't, didn't feel right. It's also awfully difficult to always sort of attribute and do all the calculations.
Yeah, because people are paying for a bundle.
They're paying for the bundle. And I think, it's a good segue, right? I mean, I think that's one of our competitive advantages. I think you've even tweeted to sort of throw back on your Twitter, subscription fatigue, right? That's sort of a thing as sort of every publisher kind of begins to try to launch a paywall or whatever it is. You know, I think our advantage is we have sort of everything in sports that someone could want. If you're a Notre Dame, Cincinnati Reds fan, and I've now married into a Lakers household, like, that bundle of content, it's not available anywhere else unless you were to go out and subscribe to, you know, 8 different newspapers and 3 other subscriptions.
So. Yeah. So you're a subscription-based service, and I know the marketing early on, at least, was, you know, no ads, no clickbait. But now you have ads, a little bit.
A little bit.
And explain that, because, I mean, it's not like a religious thing. I remember covering BuzzFeed in the early days, and, like, John Steinberg was telling, oh, we'll never do, you know, regular display advertising. And now BuzzFeed is a very big programmatic advertising business that is helping it get profitable. And none of this is sort of religious.
I think what we are religious about is less about subscription is, like, the one and only way to make money as a publisher. I think that's maybe the way it comes out, but it's not our point of view. What we do believe, though, religiously, is the user experience, reading an article, you should be able to just read the article. I think it's sort of me coming out as, like, someone that has, like, used ad blockers in the past. I just want to read the article, and I think the user experience is sacred. That's the expression we've used.
So you're not sort of anti-ads.
No, but we think
part of the model.
It really depends on the type of content. And so with audio, we've begun to have, you know, some free sort of podcasts that are out there that are ad supported partially at least, both in terms of the user experience as well as just the economics, we think it makes sense. And so, you know, a $25 CPM on a podcast advertisement versus the $2 to $3 that publishers can hope to earn with written content, you know, you can sort of see that gap. But also just the way I think users listen to audio programming, there's these little breaks and they sort of feel natural. And so we see that as still like, you know, a great user experience to listen to podcasts.
And it's a vibrant ad market. I mean, let's face it. I mean, like
it is,
at least for now, right. Particularly the kinds of podcasts, at least that I've listened to, with Birds with Friends, admittedly.
That's a good one.
Those kind of podcasts, you know, the margins can be really good on them.
That's right.
Because they're not the Gimlet podcasts that are, you know, great and everything like this, but are really expensive to produce.
Very expensive to produce. And so we're you know, with the, you know, local sports, like a team-based show that you just referenced, we're not expecting millions of listeners to each of those episodes. But if we can get each one to 10 to 20,000 folks, of which we hope a large percentage are existing subscribers, but you know, there's a decent sort of value prop to an advertiser that way. And you know, we've also back to the bundle. I mean, the fact that we're able to kind of bundle this inventory then has helped us initially. I mean, we're just early days. We've launched, you know, a bunch of shows recently, and we, you know, kind of just experimenting.
So where do you see advertising as a percentage of the revenue portfolio? Or other forms of revenue? Because, I mean, I think everyone focuses on your main form today, which obviously is subscriptions. But that doesn't mean that in like 5 years, that's the only way you're going to make money.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, for us, the way we talk about it is subscription is our foundation.
Yeah.
It will be a majority of our revenue, barring some unforeseen, you know, scenario. For as long as we're around, you know, we think that is like, it sort of flips from what, you know, some of the legacy publishers, it was sort of the opposite of that. If 2/3 was advertising, 1/3 might have been circulation. We think the opposite sort of feels a lot better. Subscription is a foundation in terms of the recurring revenues and just direct relationship with your reader. And you can start to layer things on top of that, like advertising, like events. Like, you know, I always get hit up with requests for more merchandise, which to me, that's not a huge business, but it can be sort of ancillary. Yeah. And you can sort of layer those things in over time.
What other areas? Licensing?
In terms of,
I mean,
audio,
like a lot of people, well, video. I mean, a lot of people, I don't know what the video strategy is.
Yeah, I think video is very expensive, as you know. You know, people talk about us in the same context as someone like ESPN Plus, which is spending hundreds of millions of dollars on live game rights, and they also do a lot with video. And you know, I think we've, as a, you know, well-funded but not like infinitely funded startup, I think we have to just be very thoughtful about sort of that medium, right? And so, what, you know, to date, what we've largely done is focus on storytelling. We do have a small team; they've put out some really amazing stories, kind of in the mold of, you know, like a 60 Minute Sports or an, you know, 30 for 30 sort of model. And we think there's opportunities to, you know, distribute that content.
Is the goal there to learn more or to drive subscriptions or both?
It's both. In our head, it's R&D for now, but absolutely, if there's a chance to sort of extend our brand and just grow more awareness of what The Athletic is onto another platform, we'd be sort of open to that. In the same way that, you know, at least until recently, you could watch a 30 for 30 documentary on Netflix.
So let's talk about the UK expansion a little bit, because in order to get to big numbers, let's say 10 million, I mean, you're probably going to have to go beyond the US.
For sure.
There are a lot of rabid sports fans out there in other markets, starting with the UK. And I think we have a UK team that you guys talked to at launch.
Yep.
And they were like amazed that the, you know, over there it made a big splash as far as the numbers of people that you signed up. Explain the UK strategy.
Yeah, so it was a whirlwind. You know, coming into this year, it was not sort of set in stone that we would even be launching this year over there. And, you know, so conversations early in the year led us to begin to get pretty excited. So we found a couple of folks that we'd started to talk to that could have been sort of like, you know, kind of first editorial hires to help us, you know, go do the recruiting and unlock the market. And so we did actually raise sort of a, you know, sort of an extension on our last fundraising round to, you know, support that like financially. But we, you know, basically, I think it was around April. I know because the sort of the time between saying, all right, this is happening, and the launch was like just over 100 days. It was sort of in incredible timeline. So Alex and I and the rest of the team were in London sort of frequently having meetings like face-to-face in person with writers, with editors, with just other folks, you know, this accreditation sort of organization in the market to make sure we could, you know, save a spot in the press box, those kind of things. But it was an insanely sort of accelerated sort of timeline. But what was exciting, obviously, launch has gone really, really well. You know, we sort of talked publicly, you know, we hope we can, you know, sort of be at 100,000 subscribers in the UK, you know, after a year, whatever sort of talk about that way. But it's gone really well. The talent that we've been able to assemble has been spectacular. It became more of a kind of a pull versus a push. Once we started to pick up some momentum and had hired some very good people, we became kind of the talk of sports media in London and UK for a couple of months there. And yeah, launch went really well. We're also seeing incredible adoption among US-based like soccer fans. So again, it's sort of back to that point around the bundle. You know, if you're a Man U fan, Yankees and, you know, University of Michigan, we don't think there's a better place for you as a fan to sort of get that quality.
So you want to stick to English for now?
Yeah, I think that makes things easier.
Well, there's a lot of people out there that don't speak English. There's a lot of markets and they like sports.
They do.
I'm just wondering how extensible the model is globally, because, you know, when you're talking about Netflix type numbers, and again, to go back to the New York Times, I think this is one of the issues they have as an American and an English language brand, is that there are natural barriers unless you're going to start to translate it or have entirely different language staffs.
Yeah, I think, you know, English speaking it's more accessible for now. I think we're focused, you know, we've recently crossed 500 employees in total. And so, you know, definitely want to stay aggressive, but we're also incredibly focused on, you know, we're now in 3 countries. The amount of just work and administration to support that is incredible. So we're, you know, just making sure we don't sort of lose sight of, you know, what we're trying to do with the team that we have.
Can you get to profitability without another funding round?
Yeah, I believe so. You know, we talk about, you know, we recently sort of did a small top up on our last round. And so, you know, as we've sort of mentioned, getting to 1 million subscribers puts us sort of in the driver's seat.
And that'll be this year.
We don't want to put a specific...
Why not?
You know, well, you know, we might miss it by a day or two, but we feel, you know, extremely confident that we'll get to 1 million subscribers in the next, you know, couple of quarters. And from there, we feel like we'll be in the driver's seat. If we raise more money, it's because we think there's an opportunity to keep, you know, going beyond what we do.
So. What kind of churn rates do you see?
So we typically keep, you know, 80% of our subscribers. So the vast majority of our users are on annual plans. And so it's really kind of a once a year, it's not a sort of month to month thing the way, you know, like a Netflix or a Spotify would see it. But you know, over 80% of our subscribers in those annual cohorts are renewing. And then sort of the crazy part, we always sort of have to go back and double check our numbers and the math is, going from year 2 to year 3, we pretty much keep everyone. So sort of once we get through that first year, we're seeing, you know, we think it's best in class retention rates. And, you know, people are just engaged. And so it's, you know, it's not an expensive subscription. $5 a month feels like a pretty accessible price point to us. And, you know, if you get through that first year and you're satisfied, we think the product is only getting better. We're layering in, you know, new markets, more staff, audio, sort of just additional functionality around community sections, and just the overall product just keeps getting better. And so we, you know, we think over the long term, those retention rates are realistic and will continue to just, you know, just grow.
Yeah, as the subscriber numbers get bigger, and to go to the next sort of tier, do you have to discount more or less?
Yeah,
because discounting is a fact of life in subscription businesses.
It is. I just talked to Max Willens, your staff. I don't know.
Yeah. See, it's on my mind.
It's on your mind. So we chatted last week. He was asking me, you know, what's your discount strategy? And basically what I told Max was, problem you're trying to solve is you have a user who is hitting a paywall or is hearing about The Athletic that is saying, well, why should I pay? Like, what is the point here?
You're like, no, you should pay. There's this stuff you can't see, but you should pay for it.
Right. So we're trying, but then at the same time, we have a bunch of existing subscribers who are very happy and telling us, like, wow, I'm so glad this is the best money that I spend, and you know, I would pay more potentially. And so, getting a user from that first comment to that second comment, you know, we're not as concerned with, did the person pay us $40 or $50 in the first year? It's really about like getting them to that kind of happy place. And so discounts are a great way to do that. Free trials are a great way to do that. We use both. You know, we, for special situations like your Black Friday or for launching a new market, we'll really try to incentivize, you know, that sort of adoption at those points. But I don't think in the long run we're, you know, fearful that like, you know, $5 is not going to be accessible for sports fans.
Okay. Adam, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you all for listening. This podcast was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé. Before we go, I want to give a quick thanks to Richard Fitzgerald, who tweeted another incredibly interesting episode of the Digiday podcast. I look forward to these weekly episodes like I used to Match Magazine when I was a kid. Wow. Thanks, Richard. I don't know Match Magazine, but I'm sure it was a wonderful publication. You should also check out what Richard is doing. He's building a bootstrap digital media business in the Middle East with Love in Dubai, Love in Saudi, and a sort of cheddar-like video service called Smashy TV. Anyway, we always love to hear your feedback, good and bad. Tweet me. I am at bmorrissey on Twitter, or you can email me. I'm brian@digiday.com. We'll be back next week with a new episode.